financial supporter by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. That's give to the number 2, WBAI.org online. It is now 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Agenda Radio coming up.
You're listening to Black Agenda Radio, where we provide news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Margaret Kimberly. In this week's segment, we learn about the need for expungement of criminal records for millions of people and about the implications of the Durham report on the FBI's investigation of Donald Trump. But first, we hear about Black women in Brazil, their struggles for human rights, and their desire for solidarity with Black people in the U.S., and an upcoming meeting in New York. You're listening to Black Agenda Radio. I'm Margaret Kimberly. Vanya Santana is joining us from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. She is a member of the Brazilian Black Coalition for Rights, an historian and researcher of gender and ethnic racial relations. She's a former Secretary of Human Rights of Rio de Janeiro, counselor of the National Council of Women's Rights, and consultant for the Pro-Gender and Race Equity Program and Diversity Committee of Petrobras. She's current president of the Brazilian Institute of Social and Economic Analysis. We're also joined by Natalia de Campos, an organizer with Defend Democracy in Brazil Committee, known as DDBNY. She joins us from New York. Vanya, let's start with you. What is the Black Women's Alliance?
Well, we are a group of women that are dealing with facing and struggle against racism in Brazil, racial violence specifically. And we belong, in fact, we belong to the Black movement, the women's Black movement. And you are doing this for a quite long time. That's just so important to be at the United States Black Movement to share your experience at the same time to her, what's going on there. Yeah, at that moment, that's the focus on what are you doing, what will you do, or what you think that you should do in the next few days, you know. You are a delegation of a 16 organization which belong to Black Women's Movement, Women's Movement, and Black Movement from different regions of Brazil, including the north and the northeast parts of Brazil. It's important to mention that the Black Coalition for Rights, a Coalição Negra por Direitos, of which I am a member, is a coalition that brings together 250 organizations from the Black movement and Black women's movement around the country. In addition to the Black Coalition for Rights, we will be together with the Forum of Black and Black Travesty and Transgender, which that we join in this journey. And they are the presence of the most important organization that defends or fight for the right of transgender people in Brazil. You are a group with effective work against racism in Brazil, and at the same time, with a unique and important diversity in this way of action. That's why we think that this group, 16 organization, can show it to you and also to have an input on how to face racism globally.
I'd like to ask about Black people in Brazil, and I know this is a very broad question. Can you sum up for our listeners what life is like for Black people in Brazil? What kind of conditions are you living with?
First of all, it's important to stress or just to share the information. The Afro-descendants in Brazil are the majority of the Brazilian population officially. We are 56% of Brazilian population. In Brazil, information of color and race of population is collected annually and also disclosed. Having this information collected and disseminated is result of a long negotiation process with the Bureau responsible for publishing and collected Brazil official statistics on population. That's why we know so much about our social vulnerability. It's something that we know from the daily life or daily reality, and also is confirmed by the statistics now. So we are those who are in poverty. We are those one that the highest unemployment rates. We are those who live in precarious housing. We are those one with the lowest risk of schooling. We are social group the most died victim of racial brutality from the policy. That's the question for vulnerability. Has a long history, and I think that's something that we are in common with United States, no? Or African Americans, you know? So the scenario is this social vulnerability is not something that by chance is as a result of a history of discrimination. No? And that's why it is so important for us to connect racism, racial discrimination, and social vulnerability. The lack of voice that we have in Brazil to stand up against poverty, lack of rights, lack of citizenship, because we have this strong ideological problem that is racism.
Yeah, you're correct. It does sound like the lives of Black people in this country you mentioned police murders, discrimination, poverty. All of those things impact Black people here more severely, which speaks to another issue of African-descended people all over the world and sharing these things in common. Tell us about the forum at the UN, the Afro-Descended Forum. Will people be there from other nations as well?
Yeah. Our expectation is to give visibility to this plurality of perspectives in confronting racism and racial discrimination to establish an international alliance to confront racism and racial violence. I mean, racism is a global ideology. Black women are a group particularly affected by this ideology. And we need show what we are thinking about this and what we are doing to confront this. So let's put it strongly on the political agenda. In addition to give us visibility to our work, we aim to learn about what we are doing, what you are doing as a civil society organization in the struggle against racism and racial violence. How we are dealing with policy brutality and other violation of human rights. What have you learned after the murder of George Floyd? What have you been thinking about the resurgence? Is something that is right? Resurgence, emergence, a new emergence of racial superiority ideology that bring to us the hate discourse and violence against African and African descendant. We are trying to think about what you are doing to mainstream new forms to deal with racial discrimination. What you can learn together and how to ensure that our history, for instance, how to ensure that our history include our experience against slavery and racial discrimination are not silent on the school, on society. We believe that a common past of slavery, but also your struggle against racial discrimination is something that must inspire us to action together right now, in the moment, and also in what we can learn for the future. The future is our major problem right now, you know. What we can do together to change this 21st century, you know. What you can do as Black from diaspora, as women from Afro diaspora, what you can do? Can we do something together? It's a question.
Well, I think, you know, at Black Agenda Report, we are internationalists. So we say yes, that we can and should work together. You know, you asked about George Floyd, who was killed by police. The anniversary of his killing is approaching. It was late May in 2020, which sparked a worldwide movement. And yet we here have not seen the changes that we were struggling for at that time. So I say all that to say that we here in this country can learn from other people, because we've had our successes, we've had our failures also, but we have these points of commonality, and I hope that people here take the opportunity to learn from you. First of all, to learn about the experiences of people, of Black people in Brazil, and that we are able to learn from you. And we don't think of ourselves as a group of people who somehow have some great success when that is not always true. So I think it's wonderful to have these opportunities to meet African descended people from around the world. I was going to ask about your president, Lula da Silva, your new old president. He was past president. Then there was a coup against his party. He ended up being imprisoned, but he is now back in the presidency. I wanted to ask about his presidency and Black Brazilians. What is your feeling about how he addresses issues of racism, how he addresses the issues that impact your community?
First of all, Margaret, we should point out that the majority of Black population in Brazil vote for Lula. 70% of Afro-Brazilian or Afro-Brazilian descendant voted for Lula last year. It's a rate that he always had from our community. And as I said before, related to poverty and about our lack of citizenship, for sure that we have great expectation on Lula. And I think that he is doing the best he can, better now than 10 years ago. And when I say this, it's because I think that Lula knows better now than the past the impact of racism on the how to do politics in Brazil. He has been shown, has said more clearly that racism is our problem. He is more comfortable to understand that the Black women in Brazil we have an important role to play to change politics. It's not by chance to have that we right now has a important number of Black women on the ministry. We have Aniele Franco, Margareth Menezes, Marina Silva, and others. So we have a great expectation, but we know at the same time that we are facing in Brazil fascism, intolerance. We are facing the political elite that don't want it. They never wanted to have a guy as Lula in the power. So how to deal with it? The best way to deal with it, in my opinion, is to organize people. And that's why it's so important, Black women's movement, Black movement, feminist movement, women movement, to do what we should do, organizing population for their rights, social, economical, political, and cultural. We should change this country. And Lula is an expression of changing. It's a challenge at the same time. It's a challenge at the same time. But we need to do this work that we are doing. That's the point. And we should do it globally. It's not by chance that Lula is going to Europe, United States. No, not by chance. He knows that to preserve democracy in Brazil, you should be together. And the world that has a democracy as a value should be with us on this struggle. Here, at that moment, is our common goal, is to defend democracy. And we understand that with racism, we won't have democracy. So it's important to stress the importance for democracy and at the same time, the importance to fight, to struggle against racism.
You know, it sounds familiar to me. Black people here vote overwhelmingly for the Democrats. Actually, it's like 90% of black people vote for the Democratic Party. And yet we never get the things we want. And it's something that we struggle over, having political forces, one of which is unacceptable to most of us, and the other that takes us for granted. And is that a problem in Brazil? When the black community does not get what it needs from Lula's party, is that something that people debate how to deal with?
Probably take into account what you name as a democracy. You should be aware that the political party probably you'll be the last one to understand fully the importance to struggle against racism. This is the point that you should stress. I think that community, association, women's movement, trade union movement, and so on, right now they have a more understanding about how fight against racism is important to respond more fully the expectation of population. But the political party is different because the interests inside the political party are mixing values. But anyway, it's important to struggle inside the political parts to have this space of debate. That these have been doing for, that is what black women in Brazil have been doing when they fight, when they put their name to elections. But we know the case of Marielle Franco, that he lost. She was assassinated in Rio de Janeiro few years ago. But what we say, what we learned from her, that we not give up this struggle, that we will be in politics and we try to find our space on this place. Which place? Political party. I mean that as a black people, we know that the formal institution don't want to understand fully our perspective. And political party is not a side of this challenge.
Yes, thank you. And now I'm going to turn to Natalia. Natalia, tell us about the event that your organization is hosting at the People's Forum.
So we are supporting, actually. The event is for the Alliance, the Black Women's Alliance, and by them as well. They are presenting the lines in which they are organizing the delegation and working in Brazil in three different lines. It's going to be at the People's Forum, who is also a supporter of the event. We are very grateful to be part of a member of the People's Forum. And it is on June 2nd at 5 p.m. And it is an in-person event. People who are outside of the city can also follow it on the stream of the People's Forum. and it's going to be from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. in New York. And we have, you know, been in the struggle also for many, many years. And 7 years ago, we formed around the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff and understood very quickly how racist and how, you know, biased also against women the powers that tried to remove her were. And so since then, we have had a number of events to support, but this is by far the most important because it's such an important delegation of women from north and south of Brazil. And we want to stress that you know, the Black women's movement in Brazil is as varied as the country. It is as big and as far-reaching to all kinds of different violences and struggles that they face. So we are in support of them and hope that people can join us next week. There will be an extraordinary amount of interesting perspectives on the struggle against violence against Black people in Brazil.
And how do our listeners get information about that event?
So they can go to thepeoplesforum.org. It's actually peoplesforum.org website, and the event is listed there in their calendar on June 2nd. They can also go to defenddemocracyinbrazil.org/news, which has a bilingual release on what the event is about. So we invite both the Brazilian community in New York, Portuguese speaking, as well as the English speaking community, because there will be simultaneous translation for all the speakers, simultaneous interpretation, and everybody is going to be able to engage in the conversation. There will be rounds of questions. We are also very honored, Margaret, that you have accepted our invitation to be one of the moderators in the event, and we are putting a plug here for also Sadie Mosley, who is the education coordinator of the People's Forum and who also helped to coordinate one of the roundtables.
Thank you so much. And before I go, I just wanted to ask Vanya, is there anything I did not ask you that you would want our listeners to know about?
You know, Margaret, so let me show you, or that's a reflection now. A common reflection now. Right now, the world has been talking about climate change and how it's so important to protect the Amazon region. We agree on that. It's very important for sure. But a few people know that 78% of the people who live in the Amazon region declare themselves as a black and mixed people. You have heard little about environment racism. So when we talk about change information is opportunity to give the right visibility of all lives, including the fact that we are the majority people in Amazon, you know? And in a few days, we will have the opportunity to hear from this. The question is, our agenda for human rights include, for sure, talk about our experience and our community, because we think that's the right thing to do.
And that was Vanya Santana and Natalia de Campos discussing the upcoming forum on Afro-descendants at the United Nations and the Black Women's Alliance event at the People's Forum, which will be held in New York on June 2nd. You're listening to Black Agenda Radio. I'm Margaret Kimberly. Jay Jordan is CEO of Alliance for Safety and Justice, and he also serves as co-founder and national director for the program Time Done, whose 200,000 members have advocated for more than 8 million people to seal their records and access employment and other opportunities which had been denied them. Jay Jordan joins us from New York City. So tell us about your work, and if you would like, about your experience. What happens to people who were arrested or incarcerated? How can it impact their lives forever?
Yeah, so framing it for people before I hop into the impact. A lot of Americans don't understand what the system actually is and how big it is, right? So for the last 40 years, America has spent $11.5 trillion, that's trillion with the T, building its crime response system. We don't have a traditional safety system. We have a crime response system. And this system is made up of all the things that you see in America: police, prisons, jails, probation, parole, stenographers, DAs, public defenders. All of it happens after a crime occurs. So we're not preventing crime from happening. And we built this system, this government bureaucracy, really, over 40 years, and spent $11.5 trillion doing so. $11.5 trillion is a lot of money. It's more than what we spent on Iraq and Syria. It's a nation-building strategy. And this thing is so big that it is the largest employer in the world, only second to the U.S. Department of Defense. That's how big this government bureaucracy has grown and has encroached into our communities, right? It goes, like, in terms of employers in the world, it goes the U.S. Department of Defense, the U.S. justice system, Walmart, and then the Chinese Department of Public Safety. That's, so it's a very big system that we're talking about. And it employs 2.5 million people, and it spends about $300 billion every year. So when you have a government system like that, that's responding to crime, and when you look at its bottom line, because in order for it to be successful for these, you know, many, many years, and for us to keep on pouring tax dollars into this government bureaucracy, it has to have a certain profile that gets swept up in it. And that profile, the mass majority of people that get swept up in this system, they're living either at or below the supplemental poverty line. And so this is what we're talking about, right? So when people get swept up into the system, it's mainly for economic reason. You know, they're stealing something, or they're breaking into a car, or they're robbing somebody. It's economics. They don't have the thing that they need, so they go and they break the law. It's not right. I'm not condoning breaking the law. I'm just giving facts here that, you know, people break the law in terms of theft because they just don't have the means to get what they're trying to steal. And then there's addiction and mental health, which is a large portion of people inside prisons and jails today. Prisons and jails have become America's largest mental health provider in the country. That's saying something. So you have people that have economic issues. You have people who are addicted, and you have people who have mental illness inside these prisons and jails, and are in large part the ones that are taking up a lot of space. And so if that's the people who we're talking about, then we need to really dig into what happens to them, you know, after they go through the system, because you would think that this system, if we're spending $300 billion every year, 2.5 million people are employed, and we already invested $11.5 trillion into this system, you would think that this system should correct the behavior, should be able to, hey, you know, you're stealing something. Obviously, you don't have the means to do it. Let's ensure that you don't do that again. And as you are being held accountable through the system or within the system, give you what you need so you don't commit crimes or don't break the law again. Or if you're addicted or have a mental illness, you know, we're going to help you, you know, get over that, or at least treat that. The system does not do that. And it fails 70% of the time. There's something called recidivism. Recidivism is how many, the percentage of people that come back and break the law after they get out. It's 70%. 70%. So 7 out of 10 people that go through this system get out and they come right back. And so, you know, some call that retention, right? Other call it a failure. I just say that this system is designed for people not to get the help they need, or for us to not deal with the drivers. It is just a response system that it exists, and it is not helpful in regards of stopping cycles of crime. So what happens when somebody goes through the system, right? So I want to kind of say that and set the tone before I go to like the next to answer your question, which was what happens when somebody goes through the system. Well, 9 out of 10 people that are convicted due to a plea bargain. They take a plea deal. During that plea deal, there's nowhere on there that talks about collateral consequences. And a lot of folks in America have never even heard that word, but it is a legal term that defines the economic, social, and civic sanctions that kick in after someone served their time. So these aren't like, you know, incarceration or fines or fees or restitution or probation or parole, you know, or, you know, stay away orders from the victim. These are economic sanctions, civic sanctions, social sanctions after you get out. And there are 40,000 of these laws, 40,000. So one of these laws, if you have a felony conviction, you can't coach your child's Little League team. That's just one. There's 39,999 more. The vast majority of these are employment related. So if you go into the deepest end of the justice system, meaning you went to prison and you get out, you are barred from working in entire sectors. We're talking about healthcare, education, insurance, real estate, government. You are locked out of entire sectors of communities, entire sectors of the economy. And we know that in most cities around the country, the growth industries, the people who, I mean, the jobs that are out there are all in education, healthcare, and government. You working for the county, or you working at the hospital, you working for the school district, right? Those jobs are locked out from people with records. Some are social sanctions, you know, deal with family issues. These were really enacted in the 90s around the Tough on Crime bill, where they denied people, you know, the right to get government benefits or denied people the right to see their families. And, you know, if you got a felony, then you can never adopt a kid, or you can't join the PTA, or you can't go on field trips. And so it begins to be very cumbersome on family life. And, you know, kind of the most devastating, if you can believe it, is not really the economic or the social sanctions, it's really the housing sanctions. 4 out of 5 landlords do background checks. And this causes what we call post-conviction redlining, meaning that these property management companies are redlining people out of certain neighborhoods, which forces them to live in neighborhoods that aren't really safe and aren't really healthy. And so when you drive in a neighborhood and you're seeing liquor stores and bail bonds and fast food joints and buy here, pay here loans and payday loan stores, these extractive industries, people with records oftentimes live around that because they can't live anywhere else due to the housing restrictions on them having a felony. And so you group all these people together and it turns into a really devastating place. We call that post-conviction redlining. And that's really what happens. And because the expungement laws in America, state by state, are not consistent, people with felonies can't really expunge their record or seal their record. And so they're living with these consequences for life.
You know, I don't know if it's still true, but I know in New York State, where I live, people with past felony convictions could not get a license to cut hair. I mean, just very basic things that might help someone earn a decent living. So the question becomes, is this intentional? Is the goal of this system to keep people in it?
You know, as I alluded to earlier, right? You know, you have this government bureaucracy. And again, this is government, right? Police are government workers, right? Jails are government institutions. Prisons are government institutions. Probation, parole, it's government agencies. This is government we're talking about. It's a big government bureaucracy. And when people say recidivism, you know, the percentage of people going back their first year is 70%. That's retention because it fails. And whether it's intentional or not, I believe that the intention is to punish and not to support and help. Right. And so whether it's like, you know, some evil plot to lock all black people up or brown people up, I think that it may be a little far, but I do think that, you know, and I do know that the data supports that when we do not look at drivers and just deal with straight up what, like the result, or the reaction to that driver, then you're going to get the results that you get, which is people not, you know, getting what they need to be successful. And so in that regard, it's intentional because it's not fixing the problem.
Who profits from this system? You talked about employment. How many millions of people work in this system? Who makes money? What kind of individuals and corporations profit from this system?
Yeah, so that $300 billion in tax money that I mentioned, that pays for pensions, that pays for salaries, that pays for contracts. So everyone who contracts with this system, I mean, it's not just, you know, let's start with the police, right? Look at all the people that contract with the police, people who wash the police car, you know, who dry cleans their clothes, right? Who cuts their hair, you know, look at the courts, the cleaning company in the courts, the landscaping company, you know, the people, look at the jail, the people who contract to feed the people in jail that provide medical, right? The pharmaceutical company that provide the medication for people, the diabetic medication for people, right? You get the prisons, the people who maintain the prisons, all the contracts in the prisons, the workers, the free, they call them free staff, the dentists, the eye doctors, the regular doctors, the psychologists, you know, and then get to the actual government workers, the police, the prison guards, the probation, you know, agents, the parole agents. I mean, that's who benefits. It's government. Government is benefiting from, you know, us not having a true safety system that prevents crime from happening.
And helps others, because you mentioned contracts. So these are private corporations. So the government makes money and helps others make money. Yeah. You mentioned that all these laws worsened in the 90s during the, you know, the war on drugs, mm-hmm. the Bill Clinton's crime bill, which then mm-hmm. Senator Joseph Biden bragged about helping bring about. I think there was such a climate of fear mm-hmm. that was created. And I know that in the intervening years, a lot of people have questioned what began during that time. How do we, as individuals, how do we advocate to make these changes? Because all of these things are allegedly done to help us, to keep us safe, mm-hmm. to, mm-hmm. you know, but that's not what really happens. What can the average person do to try to undo all of this damage?
Yeah, so, you know, it really started in the 70s. You know, it started because, you know, the country didn't push to implement civil rights, right? Like the civil rights bill integrated our remove restrictions for certain people in America to access certain stuff, right? And the implementation should have been an economic plan for those disenfranchised communities. Instead, right, in the 70s, after 68, when the bill was signed, in the 70s, you had deinstitutionalization, you know, the closing down of state hospitals and all those people with mental illness flooding the streets. You had people coming home from war, addicted to opioids. You had deindustrialization, the great U-turn, America going from an industrial economy to a manufacturing economy to a service economy. So people were losing jobs. Factories were closing down. And, you know, you had black folks saying, hey, I want to work. Like, where's my support? So the government said, okay, well, we'll give you some welfare. Right? We'll create welfare, but we're also going to clean up your streets and give the government, your local government prison, money for prisons and jails and cops. So they they flooded the streets with substations. There were no police stations in black communities back in the day. There were no substations in the projects in the 60s. Like, no, that stuff came because people pathologize what we actually needed. And then the 80s hit and we didn't deal with the problem. We didn't build the mental health infrastructure locally. We didn't build the addiction services locally. We didn't build the housing and the economic, you know, safety nets locally, regionally. And so when crack hit in the 80s, people were like, oh my God, it worsened and the streets got worse. And they didn't deal with it. They just started a war on drugs. They started a war. Instead of saying we want to support, they started a war on drugs in the 80s. And then when that didn't work and people turned to guns, right? You know, they started a war on crime in the 90s. And so we've gotten these wars on American citizens instead of, you know, doing what people have been calling for, which is safety, giving us what safety truly means. They gave us government and more government. And we just keep getting the government expanding itself. It happened in, after 9/11, fear-based economy. People wanted retribution and togetherness. It was the first time like pro-black folks were like, I'm an American. I like, this is wrong. And instead of us getting safety, we got TSA, we got Homeland Security, we got the militarization of school police. You know, we got background checks. And then when people stood up against police terrorism, you know, in black communities in the 2010s, right now we got more rhetoric about the streets are bad and crime is on the rise and we need law and order. We got Trump. Every single person in this country need to be saying the same thing. I want to be safe. And safety does not mean pour more money into government. Safety means to pour more money into these babies, pour more money into these families, pour more money into these parks, pour more money into economic empowerment and workforce development. Get these young men back to work. Get them something to do after school, right? And it's not difficult. These programs exist, but they don't exist at scale because all the money that it would take to scale these is locked up in the government bureaucracy we call the American justice system.
You know, it's interesting you talk about government. You know, government could be used to do some of those things. Mm-hmm. There could be a government job program. There could be improvements in public assistance. There could be more. They've eradicated a lot of public housing and so on. So I think the question is, what is government money going to be used to do? And cause, so you have a choice that you can build public housing or you can build prisons. You can improve school systems or you can build juvenile jails. So the issue is, what is the choice that's made by the state that we live in?
Yeah, and that's the bottom line. State, the counties and the cities, hold them accountable to the decisions that they are making about where your money goes.
The organizations you're involved in, tell us how they help individuals. How does someone returns home from after being incarcerated? They want to make a change. They want to make a positive change in their lives. But depending on where they live, that may be very difficult. What is it that your organizations do to help those folks?
Yeah, so we run state-based policy. We pass laws. We change laws. In the last 10 years, we passed over 100 laws. Laws that has reinvested $3 billion from the government bureaucracy and put it into communities and cities around the country that pay for education and victim services and mental health services and reentry and job programs. We've gotten over 8 million people access to expungement. We've gotten over 1.5 million people access to voting rights. We've built over three dozen trauma recovery centers in communities. And so we've been working very, very hard on behalf of all of our members. We have over 400,000 members. 200,000 are victims of crime, are identified survivors of crime, and 200,000 identify as having a record. And we work in tangent to pass these laws and to implement these laws to change real lives. I mean, people say laws don't change lives. Well, I changed a law in California that allowed me to get my record expunged. And I just got my record expunged 2 weeks ago. Right. So changing laws do work.
Well, congratulations about that. But that must have been quite a struggle.
Yeah, it took us 5 years. And we didn't take the easy road. We changed the entire expungement framework in California. Like, everything about expungement has changed because of the work that we did. We were intentional. We worked with government, to your point, right? Like, we worked with the county courts. We worked with the Department of Justice at the state level. We worked with judicial counsel. We were responsible. We told the DAs, hey, here's what we're going to do. We told the sheriffs and police, here's what we're going to do. We didn't hide it. We didn't, you know, be secretive about it. We were very upfront and said these processes and this government bureaucracy and red tape needs to change. And so we cut the red tape, shrunk government processes, saved the state some money. And now everybody has access to expungement in California.
So this means someone who when they're released, their So you mentioned, for example, landlords do background checks. So as a result of this legislation, past conviction would not show up in a background check?
If a person gets an expungement, that conviction will not show up on that type of background check. If you are trying to work in education or around vulnerable populations or get your gun rights back or work for government, it'll show up. But everything else, it won't show up.
I think that a lot of these laws succeeded because there was so much fear-mongering. Well, I don't want somebody with, someone might say, I don't want someone with a criminal conviction working in a nursing home where my grandmother mm-hmm. is. What's your response to that?
That person not the grandmother. That person probably is a granny, so they can't take care of themselves. At what moment in time do people redeem themselves? How long? Is it 1 year? Is it 2 years? Is it 3 years? What if they don't commit crimes for 10 years? Are they the same person 10 years ago? Were you the same person 10 years ago? I know the person I was 20 years ago when I went to jail. I wouldn't let that guy sleep on my couch. He was an 18-year-old crazy kid. You know, I'm a dad now, two boys. I'm a husband. I'm a dog owner. I got two dogs, two toy poodles. I'm have no desire to take anything from anybody else. And so at some moment in time, we have to stop looking at people's past as a prediction for future actions. If that past is something they did when they were a kid, I know a lot of people who did some crazy stuff when they was getting out of high school, transitioning to college. And most people with records, they got caught up. Some people went to college. Some people went to jail. I was one of the guys who went to jail after I graduated. And so, you know, if you don't want me to work, if you don't want me to have a house, what do you want me to do? What's the alternative? So there's 80 million of us, you know, 80 to 100 million of us. What you want us to do? You don't want us to work and have jobs and take care of ourselves and our families?
How do our listeners find out about the work that you do? Where do they find that information?
Yeah, so you can follow me on all platforms. It's at Mr. J. Jordan, just like the color purple, M-I-S-T-E-R, J-A-Y-J-O-R-D-A-N. Mr. J. Jordan, spelled all the way out. Or you can follow us on all platforms at Time Done.
And that was J. Jordan of the Alliance for Safety and Justice and Time Done, discussing the effort to expunge records for millions of people in the United States. You're listening to Black Agenda Radio. I'm Margaret Kimberly. I was recently a guest on the Sputnik program, The Critical Hour, with co-host Garland Nixon. I discussed the Durham Report and the FBI's history of violating the law.
Everyone, go to blackagendareport.com. Great website. I check it out every day, updated on Wednesdays. Plenty to read about. Durham Report reveals the real threat to democracy, the FBI weaponized by Democrat Party-affiliated elites. Margaret Kimberly.
Yeah, this week we saw the finally the Durham report on Russiagate, and it's somewhat disappointing because it doesn't give us the detail that we should have about how all this began. But it's very clear that Hillary Clinton and her people were involved in starting the investigation of Donald Trump during the 2016 election, and that the FBI had no justification for starting what was called Operation Crossfire Hurricane to investigate Trump. And this is it's somewhat problematic because they don't talk enough about how this took place. The fact that the DNC law firm paid for the Steele dossier, so much was made of that. That was supposed to be the proof that Trump was colluding with Russia. But we know what anybody who's paying attention now has some confirmation, more confirmation that, as Ajamu says in his great article, the FBI was weaponized by the Hillary Clinton campaign in order to try to destroy Donald Trump. And I think it is ironic that instead of cooking this up, all she really needed to do was have a decent get out the vote effort in swing states. And she ended up losing to him anyway. But Ajamu has a larger point about how the FBI is a political organization. It is not an independent law enforcement agency. It acts on the behalf of political actors. And in this case, it was a Democratic Party elite who used the FBI to try to derail the Trump campaign. And he goes, Ajamu Kamau, you know, makes a further connection with the African People's Socialist Party and the indictment of some of their members. And he makes the case that this is a political organization and that this is one of the connections to Russiagate. This idea that there is there are Russian efforts to influence elections and to interfere with politics in this country, it allowed for the attack on the African People's Socialist Party as well.
You know, in November 17th, excuse me, 2017, James Bovard over at The Hill wrote an article. I'm going to read a paragraph based on, you know, it's salient, especially based on what you just said. A 1924 ACLU report warned that the FBI had become a secret police system of a political character. In the 1930s, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court feared that the FBI had bugged the conference room where justices privately wrangled over landmark cases, as Tim Weiner noted in his, quote, enemies, a history of the FBI. In 1945, President Harry Truman noted that, quote, we want no Gestapo or secret police. FBI is tending in that direction. FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover compiled a list of 20,000 potentially or actually dangerous Americans who could be rounded up and locked away in one of six detention camps the federal government actually secretly built in the 1950s. I'm sure both of our names would be at the top of the list, Margaret. Is the FBI the Gestapo or the secret police of the U.S. empire?
Well, sure it is. And it's not the only agency either. There's we've got the CIA. We've got the NSA. All these, speaking of Russiagate, remember they said 17 intelligence agencies had all said Trump colluded. And I said, I didn't know we had 17 intelligence agencies. But at any rate, yes, absolutely. This is a long history, and I'm sure they did. This was J. Edgar Hoover, who ran that agency for decades, one of the worst public officials ever in modern U.S. history. And we see this continuation of what the FBI did with back in the days of McCarthyism, people who were smeared, people who went to jail, people who had their passports taken, people who were driven out of the country, COINTELPRO, the FBI being involved in trying to and succeeding in destroying the Black Panther Party, creating dissension, putting people in jail, getting people to kill each other, all kinds of things. And this never ends. That is the nature of the state. It's the nature of an organization like the FBI. And so when we hear the FBI did this or that or said this or that, we have to keep all of those things in mind because we have, and Trump is very problematic, of course, but you see what they did even to a Republican, a conservative Republican, to try to keep him out of office. I think they were afraid he actually meant some of what he said about improving relations with Russia and some other things that strayed from the establishment orthodoxy. So if they would do this to the Republican nominee, they'll do it to anybody, to you, to me, to anyone.
One of the things that Ajamu brings up from the report, based on the review of Crossfire Hurricane and related intelligence agencies, we conclude that the department and the FBI failed to uphold their mission of strict fidelity to the law. And he brings this up. In other words, they operated beyond the boundaries of the law. So wait a minute. And here's something that I think is important about this report. Durham basically says they violated the law. They didn't. I mean, that's a kind way of saying it. Hey, Garland went in a bank and walked out, went in a bank with a gun and walked out with $450,000. Well, he didn't uphold the strict fidelity of the laws that say you won't rob banks, but he's going to get charged. That's the other part. You find criminality all over this thing. Nobody's getting charged, which means nothing's going to change, Margaret.
Yes, and that's one of the disappointments of this report. To me, I know it's 300 pages or something like that, but as far as I'm concerned, it's incomplete because it doesn't talk about Hillary Clinton's, her connections with the intelligence community, these shadowy characters, this Professor Mifsud, this helper, this guy in England, the Australian diplomat who entrapped, I believe, this man named Papadopoulos, mm-hmm. and again, you know, Papadopoulos and others, nobody was convicted of colluding with Russia. They were all convicted of process crimes. If Papadopoulos hadn't talked to the FBI, he wouldn't have been guilty of anything. All of this is, these are things that really demand investigation, but as you just pointed out, we'll never have it. We will just have the innuendo that unfortunately most people accept as being true about Trump and those of us who have been paying attention not getting the full story.
And that was my conversation on the Critical Hour regarding the Durham report and the implications of FBI lawbreaking. Thank you for joining this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue every Wednesday.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Activist Sharon Salam speaks out for WBAI.
We should be moving forward, collecting the funds that we need to make sure that our station is whole and that it can do its job as it has done for me in the past. When all of this stuff happened to me many, many years ago in 1989, I didn't get very many opportunities to speak out in regards to the wrong that was done to my son and the other boys in the Central Park jogger case, as it was called at that time. Very few people stepped up. Yes, Like It Is was there, WBAI was there, and a few others. Majority of those stations that let people like myself speak and tell them what was going on the other side, those stations are gone. If we lose WBAI, where do we go to get our words out? Where do we go if you've been arrested unjustly? Where do you go if someone's taken your children unfairly? Where do you go to seek justice? We must keep this station alive. Yeah. Alive. WBAI.
No justice. This is listener-sponsored, locally-controlled WBAI New York.
Do you think this war will ever end?
I don't know. They'll just have another one.
I want to get out of here. Don't you?
Not that much.
So you like it here?
It's not that bad.
You're in a foxhole with a war raging outside.
I know. That's why I'm sure glad I've got my WBAI.
Be glad you've got your WBAI. Become a member online at WBAI.org. Now, do it now.
You're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. My name is Bill Samuels, founder of NYPeople'sConvention.org. WBAI is New York's leader in progressive talk. Whether the issue is prison reform, education reform, the legalization of marijuana, or women's rights, the people's issues are covered on these airways. So stay tuned for the best and leading-edge progressive ideas and analysis. And remember to support independent media financially.
Hi, this is Roger McGuinn. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM. There is a season.
this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over, and there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
Thank you, my good man. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. And like Contadina,